In the summer of 2023, Maine Public partnered with StoryCorps in a Military Voices initiative to capture the stories of Maine veterans who served in the armed forces. During the recording sessions, veterans shared details about their tours of duty and how their time in the military affected both their lives and those of their loved ones. This limited podcast series is dedicated to these Maine veterans and their families. We want to thank them for sharing moments of their lives with us. I'm Keith Shortall. Let's get started. Episode 9, Remembering the 31. In 1969, over the Sea of Japan, a U.S. Navy plane was shot down by North Korean fighter planes. All 30 sailors and one Marine were lost. It was one of the greatest losses of a U.S. crew during the Cold War era. In today's episode of Military Voices of Maine, we'll meet Lieutenant Brian Nickerson, a Vietnam War veteran who served with the members of that lost flight. He talks about how the U.S. government and President Richard Nixon reacted, and why he believes no action was taken after such a tragic loss of life. I'm Keith Shortall, and today we're remembering the 31.
My name is Brian Nickerson. I'm 80 years old.
My name is Jeb Bakke. I am 26 years old. Today's date is June 1st, 2023. We are in Fort Williams Park in Maine. And Brian, I understand you have a chronological start to your story, so I'll turn it over to you. Let's hear it from the beginning, I suppose.
Yes. Well, I'm one of those people that got drafted for the Vietnam War. We just graduated from college, my wife and I, and we got married relatively soon in July of 1965 because they weren't taking married men for the draft, and I wasn't particularly comfortable going to the Vietnam War, which I ended up going, but so we graduated from college, and I became draft eligible. We got married, and all of a sudden, we weren't going to be drafted. That was July. August, however, they changed the rules, so all of a sudden I was draft eligible again. And in November, I got my draft notice, and the next morning, I was standing outside the Navy recruiter when they opened the door, and I enlisted in the Navy, but I had 3 months where I didn't have to go for active duty, so I tried to get into officer candidate school, and that was successful, and I was going to go to the officer candidate school in Pensacola, Florida. At the time I had to report for duty, which was October 1966, my daughter, my first daughter, was being ready to be born, but I didn't get to see her for 2 months. I got a call in the middle of the night and found out my daughter, Christine, was born. Back then, you didn't know what they were going to be until they actually got born, so I did get to see her around Christmas for 2 weeks' leave, and she was 2 months old, and I got a big smile from her, so I guess that was pretty good. I got commissioned as in the U.S. Navy in January of 1967. Happened to be Friday the 13th, and I don't know if that was an omen, but that's the day I got commissioned. In about August of 1967, we had to drive to Denver, Colorado, and I was going to be taking a school in Air Intelligence, Armed Forces Air Intelligence Training Center. During the process, while I was going through the school, the Navy kind of asks you where you would like to be assigned. And I picked, you get to choose three. And the second choice was a squadron in Japan called the Fleet Air Reconnaissance Squadron 1. And shortened up to VQ1, V meaning fixed wing aircraft, Q meaning intelligence, and it was the number one squadron in that. And it was the largest squadron in the Navy. So I didn't think I was going to Vietnam until I reported for duty. And when I reported for duty, I found out I was going to be in Vietnam 2 days later. So all of a sudden, Vietnam was going to be part of my life for the next 2.5 years. That 2 days, we went down to Vietnam, and I got off the plane, and I was standing under the stars in the Republic of South Vietnam and not knowing what was going to happen. You're going into the war zone for the first time, so you really don't know if all of a sudden there's going to be shooting or bombs or rockets. As it turned out, it was relatively boring, although we would get attacks, rocket attacks at night. There were a couple of times it was very dangerous, and most of the time it wasn't dangerous at all. We had reconnaissance that we would report to the 7th Fleet of the Navy, the Defense Department, and the Naval Security Group, which is the arm of the National Security Agency, NSA. Our mission was the entire east coast of Asia, starting all the way from as far north in Siberia as you could go, all the way down to Vietnam. And we had to cover all that in our missions. We collected signal intelligence, which is usually radar, and radar-related activities, for example, using radar to shoot surface-to-air missiles or anti-aircraft artillery, and the other one's communications intelligence.
What was your role?
I was an intelligence officer, so we briefed crews. We would collect the intelligence, and we'd report it and send it off to the Department of Defense, mostly the Department of Defense. And then they would take that, and whether it went to the Naval Security Group or not, I don't know. We had three different aircraft. One of the reasons we were a very large squadron is that we had four-engine airplanes that carried 31 people, and then we had two-engine jet planes that carried 7. They would do similar missions, although the one with 31 people did a much larger and more comprehensive job of it. Part of the reason we were the largest squadron is we had two different kinds of aircraft with two different kinds of engines, two different kinds of airframes, two different kinds of things. But the only thing that was common between the planes was the coffee maker. Now what I want to talk about is the incident that I think is important here. A year before, the North Koreans came out and basically took a U.S. ship called the USS Pueblo, and they captured the crew. One crewman died, and that was in 1968. Most people know that when you say the USS Pueblo, a lot of people know what that is. But if you tell them about the incident that happened a year later with, and not just one person, but 31 people died, they don't remember it. It's one of those it's a forgotten incident, and that's the reason I'm trying to get the word out, just like most of the people who have been in the squadron and were aware of this. And so this happened in April 15th, 1969, and I'm going to paraphrase a memoir that I wrote for my daughters and granddaughters in 2016, when my oldest daughter was turning 50.
And this is about the second event you're referring to, not the USS Pueblo, but the
event. Yeah, because the way USS Pueblo, this was one of our squadron airplanes and with a lot of good friends. In April 11th, 1969, I left for one of my regular deployments to Da Nang, where our squadron was in Vietnam. 3 days after I left for Da Nang, they flew one of the standard 10-hour missions 80 miles off the coast of the Vladivostok area of Russia and the east coast of North Korea. About 6 hours into the mission, two MiG-21 fighter aircraft intercepted our plane. This was not unusual because the Russians did it regularly. Those intercepts were a mixture of training for the Russian pilots as well as to let the U.S. know we were being watched. Sometimes the intercepts were good sport, sometimes extended fingers being swabbed. One time the pilot held up a can of American-made beer. These two MiGs, though, weren't from Russia. They were from North Korea. Their purpose was not to intercept our aircraft. Their purpose was to shoot it down. Warnings had been broadcast to our plane in code, so it was surmised that the crew started evasive maneuvers. It is difficult for a large and slow target like an EC-121 to evade two supersonic jets. Two heat-seeking missiles, air-to-air missiles, were launched from the fighters, and one impacted the wing, tearing it away from the fuselage, and the plane descended out of control and crashed into the Sea of Japan. There were 31 men aboard. I was sitting in Da Nang with everyone else waiting for news that would trickle in. Initially, we didn't know who was aboard. Later in the day and through the night, nobody slept that night. We got bad news of the crew members' names and all that were presumed lost. All of us in Da Nang were grieving. All branches of the U.S. military services went on the highest alert, and everyone was preparing for war. The White House and the Pentagon were busy assessing the situation and in the end decided against any retaliatory action. Now, the part of Nixon was that he just became president 3 months before the event, and he had criticized Johnson about his lack of doing anything for the Pueblo incident. one person died, and here was Nixon with 31 people died. He wasn't going to have a new war going on. Already, people were really uncomfortable with the Vietnam War, and there was a lot of protests, and there was a lot of discontent in the United States. So going to war with North Korea, where China and Russia would probably join them, probably a world war. There was no, the U.S. was not particularly interested in having a war like that, and neither would Europe, which was just getting back from World War II. So basically, we'd be doing it alone, and we would not have a lot of support. So Nixon, after complaining about Johnson, he killed the news after one press conference. After that, as far as the White House was concerned, the government, or anybody else, didn't happen. So that's the reason this event is not really known as much as the Pueblo.
Well, I thank you for telling us all about it today. It really is, I appreciate your candor and all the different aspects of your experience there. It really means a lot to me. Thank you.
Thank you.
We want to thank Lieutenant Brian Nickerson for sharing his story of what happened to the 31 service members who lost their lives on that tragic flight in 1969. As we approach Veterans Day, we want to take the time to remember those who lost their lives while serving their country. We also want to thank all the veterans who have served. In our final episode of Military Voices of Maine, we'll meet specialist Justin Spencer and his wife Emily. They'll share what it's like being married to a service member and talk about how important the support of family and loved ones can be to those who serve. Military Voices of Maine is brought to you by a partnership with Maine Public and StoryCorps, as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This podcast series was made possible through the generous support of Lee Auto Malls, Wreaths Across America, and FedCap Maine. The series was produced by Allison New and Keith Shortall. That's me. You can listen to this podcast and others like it on our website, mainepublic.org, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.